All right, welcome to class. I hope you all had yourselves a very grateful holiday. Before we get underway, are there any thoughts, comments, questions, other things for me? Yeah.
So, I assume that, so all the quizzes are weighted the same.
Yes.
But then, like, having a three-question quiz weighted the same as, like, a 20-something question.
Yeah.
Seems a little not unfair.
It does. It does. I should totally upweight the three-question quiz, shouldn't I? No. I certainly am capable of changing the weightings of the quizzes, and I have toyed with making every question weighed the same, but meh. So I will likely take the two half-week quizzes and make them weighed half what the full-week quizzes are, but otherwise leave them all the same. I will also drop your lowest quiz score. I might drop two. I haven't looked at scores yet and seen if that seems appropriate. My basic assumption is everybody has a bad day. Probably every week. So maybe I should drop a larger percentage. Anyway. Other questions? All right. So if you look at the, where do I have this? If we look at the schedule for today, first off, there's only four more classes. So I know quite a lot about next week's topics. This week's topics, I know enough to teach the class. This is one of those things that I don't think people think carefully about. It's like you don't magically, when you get your PhD, you know everything. So I'm ahead of where I hope we will get to today on these topics. These are not things I'm experts in, and so hopefully I won't make any bloomers. And we'll plow ahead. So let's just start by saying that. But today we're going to talk about real-time stuff, real-time graphics, and how to make it prettier. So real-time graphics, you've played around with the base algorithms and that, written them by hand in homework 4. Made a simple version of them that uses the hardware in homework, in homework 2 you wrote them by hand, in homework 4 you used a simple version that uses the hardware. And this leaves out a lot of things that we might actually care about. So we're actually going to start with, I think, the second link, shadows. Shadows, if you can add one thing that's not easy to your real-time graphics, shadows are probably the thing to pick. Because shadows are the things that keep things from looking like they're floating in space. Right. There's all kinds of effects with lighting, and we talked about global illumination and so on, but if you could just get shadows down, it looks like something's sitting on something instead of hovering in the middle of nowhere. And so we're going to talk about a couple of different techniques for shadows today, and we'll also talk about some other things we want to do. As we're going to dive into this, one of the things we're going to find for almost all of the how do we make real-time graphics cooler, the basic trick is we're going to try to get something that requires ray tracing, but simplify the world until we know exactly what we have to check. So we're gonna do something similar-ish to ray tracing in some way. We're gonna be careful about how we use it so that we don't have to check for lots of things. And so we're gonna see a couple of different variants of that today. One of them actually sort of won't do that for this, but I'm gonna start with that idea. So how do we represent a shadow? There are ways that people used to do that have basically fallen out of fashion. So let's start with the old, simple ways. One was, you have your complex geometry of whatever you're trying to make, and then you just have a single quad beneath their feet that has a ghostly sort of circular shadow image. And so you make this fuzzy shadow image that just goes around underneath them. And this actually works surprisingly well. It gives the cue, how far are you from the ground? You know it's not a real shadow, and so it doesn't work well if you're trying to do photorealism or the like, but if you're just saying, here's some character, there's the ground, this works pretty well. It involves drawing two triangles and one texture map. There are some tricks to getting this to work. Basically, you have to what's called biasing the depth buffer. So you need to draw this at a closer depth than is actually there so that round off doesn't make it bump into the ground. But that's a relatively easy thing to do. You just add a little bit to your depth before you draw, or subtract a little bit, I guess, and away you go. So this is a very easy way of getting the concept of shadow across. And if you go look, you can probably find more than one game of some sort that uses something like this. It's just, we need to get across the idea we're on ground. We're going to put some sort of image beneath us to make this work. Yes?
Did you say this modified
name? I don't know of a name for it. It probably does, but I don't know of a name for it. I have seen it discussed in a few sort of tutorials as simple shadows or easy shadows or some generic term like that before they get into whatever they really want to talk about, which is exactly what we're going to do in this lecture. There is a way of making this. I am making a version of their geometry that will work and give you actual shadows if you know that your ground is flat. So you could take this, and there is actually a matrix that will copy the geometry of whatever this is into some sort of flat version of it on the ground. This is a singular matrix, but it's not hard to create this matrix. They'll just flatten it onto some plane. So if the ground is a plane, and always a plane, you can just draw the entire geometry once with lighting, once flattened in black, and you can get across an actual shadow. This turns out to more than double rendering times because you have to do the compression and just change what the geometry is in there. It only works on flat ground. You still have to do some depth biasing. I have only seen this used a couple of times. This is sort of an early technique before we got more advanced ones of getting exact shadows used in various demos and things. So we have two ways of creating separate geometry, simple or complex. Both of them are limited in the kinds of ground they can do, limited in what they can be cast upon. So let's talk about how we actually do shadows in real-time games. There's two main techniques we have. We have shadow volumes, and we have shadow mapping. Each of these have multiple variants inside, and we're going to try to give a brief understanding of each of them. And I should have written them in the other order, because we're actually going to talk about shadow mapping first. Okay, so shadow mapping is a technique that's designed to get shadows across. And the basic trick we're going to do here is we're going to make our ray tracing really easy. Okay, how can we make the ray tracing really easy? So if we think about how we do shadows in ray tracing, we have something that is receiving the shadows, something that is casting the shadows, any source of light. And once we look at some point, what do we need to do? We need to shoot a light at a ray at the light. And we need to figure out, what did we hit? Okay. So to know whether we hit something or not, we need to check all of the objects in the scene to see if they're in the way of this ray. And we want to make that process more efficient. So what we're going to do is we're going to pre-compute for the light how far away the edge of shadows is. So we think about the shadow. The shadow cast by the sphere starts on one face of the sphere, and then extends outward away from the light. And so we can think of, and this is sort of the idea we'll get into more of shadow volumes, a shadow is a three-dimensional shape. It's all of the things that are farther away from the light than the closest surface to the light. And I did not draw very straight lines there, did I? Not that it probably matters. That's better. Okay. So we have this concept that there is this volume that exists. All we care about, all we need to know for any given point, if this point knows how far away from the light it is, okay, and it knows how far away from the light that same area's shadow depth is, then we're farther away from the light than the shadow, then we're in shadow. And so we need to have some rapid way for any point in the scene of figuring out how far we are from the light. That's easy. We can just do that. We need to know how far away that direction is from the shadow caster. Question?
What are you pre-computing?
So we're going to pre-compute this depth here. We're going to pre-compute S. We're going to pre-compute S for every seat point in the scene. Efficiently. Sorry? Yes, for each light, for every point in the scene, we're going to compute S. Okay? How are we going to do that? Well, the first thing we're going to do is we're not going to use bulbs. We're going to use instead Kleegs. We're going to use directional lights. These lights that cast light in a frustum. So we're going to say, all right, this light, it only goes in this direction. So we're going to limit its angle. Once we've limited its angle, we actually have very efficient techniques for finding out how distant things are in the scene are. We're going to render the whole scene from the source, pointing in that direction, using a frustum, but we're only going to keep the depth buffer. So we're going to render the whole scene from the light's perspective. We're going to ignore color. We're just going to keep the depth buffer. Because we're ignoring color, just keeping the depth buffer, we can do it faster than we can the real scene. We don't have to worry about textures or anything like that. Okay? We get the depth buffer, and then all we need to do for any given point is figure out how far it is from the light, but also this depth buffer is going to be a raster from the camera's point of view of how far away everything was. And so I need to know for any given point in the scene which texel of that depth buffer did I hit. And that I can do with a couple of dot products based on the direction from the light. So we do a couple of dot products from the point we found, the light location to find the U and V to look up in the texel. We then get its depth value. Then we then undo the frustum part to turn that back into linear depth and compare it. Question. It's the depth from the light. Okay. Yes, so this is rendered from the light's perspective. Yes?
So it seems here that like the resolution of like what pixels are gonna hit the depth buffer and what pixels are gonna be in your screen space are different. Is that like the shadow quality, I guess?
Yeah, so right, the more pixels I have in my depth buffer, the crisper I can make my shadows. Yeah?
Why do you do and then undo the frustum transformation for the light?
Well, I need to render from the frustum's point of view, and then I also need to render from the camera's point of view, and those are two different frustums. But the frustum is also going to do a Z component. It's going to squash Z from the real world Z into one negative one to one, because that's how our hardware works. And so our points are going to, the easiest way to find their distance is not in that space. It's in a Euclidean space, right? And so we need to turn this hyperbolic space, which is what frustums actually do to depths, into Euclidean space. So we can do it either direction, but we have to do one of the transformations needs to be undone so we can compare them to see if we're farther or not. Yeah?
So if you wanted to simulate a bulb, would you just have to do multiple frustums from a light?
Yeah, so you could pick a light and you could say do six frustums to make it look like a cube or whatever you wanted to do. From that point to create multiple of these texture maps, and then we'll need one extra piece. For every point, we'll need to know which of those things we're in and where we are in it, and there we can go from there. Okay, this creates some, if we don't have a high resolution buffer here, and we almost never do because high resolution is slow. If we have a low resolution depth buffer for our light, our low resolution shadow map, then we're going to have artifacts where you will see the boundaries of the pixels in the shadow. And so what we do is we just blur it. We literally just take, either we blur this or more often when we come back here, we take several surrounding pixels and average them to decide. And this will create soft shadows. We don't create soft shadows because we want them. We create them because they keep you from seeing the pixels. And so this will almost always create soft shadows. Now, you can make a high resolution buffer here. And so the Wikipedia article walks through, and they assume you have quite a high resolution. They get a nice crisp shadows, and they walk through the basic technique. Okay. As they're going along, they have this idea here, right? We render the scene from the light's perspective, but we only care about the depth buffer. They have this idea, and it'll almost always be explained this way. Imagine we projected the depth buffer onto the scene. That's hard computation. We don't do that except pixel by pixel backwards, right? It's not, so we can do that, but this is sort of, if we took this and mapped it over there, that's what it would look like, but we don't do that. Instead, we just check to see, are we in shadow or not? And so we end up with some areas that are in shadow, some areas that are not, and we can control whether that light contributes to the scene in that spot or not. And I believe they did this at a high enough shadow resolution that they don't have any pixelization effects here in their example. Okay? And so we have this idea. Questions about shadow mapping? Yes?
Does this give different intensities of shadows, or is it just yes or no?
It's a yes, no check. I mean, we could do something to the depth buffer to make it, to do something like if one of your neighboring pixels, right? So this is commonly what we do here. This point here will say, this and all of its neighboring pixels are in shadow, so we'll make it black. But one over on the boundary will say, this one's in shadow, but two of its eight neighbors are not in shadow, so make it a little bit lighter. And that's how we get the soft shadow effect. Yeah?
It doesn't have normal color.
It has no normal computation, correct. It has no bouncing light, it's just where is their shadow.
But if you had multiple light sources.
You could do it once for each of them, and so you could be in one shadow and not in another. Yeah?
If you tried to render it like that sphere, would it just be white? Because there's no normal computation.
Well, so this only tells me, does the light come into play? When the light does come into play, we'll use Lambert's law and Phong and so on, like normal. Yeah. So it just turns on or off that light for any given point, or partially on if we check some neighboring pixels to see if it's fully illuminated. Other questions about this idea? Okay. There's some nice things about this. It only uses hardware we already have. It's a fairly simple fragment shader check. Once you get it all set up and get your hyperbolic geometry undoing fixed correctly for your shadow map depths. And so it's used a fair amount. However, it has the fuzzy effect that we are used to shadows being fuzzy, but we're used to them being crisper is the thing that casts the shadow gets closer to them, penumbra effects. So that doesn't apply here. It also has difficulty if things are at dramatically different scales. Because when you think about it, how about this pixel right there? Is that in shadow? We're going to find it has almost exactly the same depth, is almost exactly the same distance from the light as our shadow map has. And so what we have to do is some sort of biasing to avoid self-shadowing. Okay? We need to bias based on the resolution of our depth map, how many depth bits we had. So we're going to have to pretend that every point is closer to the light than it actually is. And that will cause all kinds of artifacts if things are very close to the light or if the light is going over a huge distance. All of those approximations get a little fuzzy. So it works well if the light's sort of a relatively constant distance from a relatively constant sized things. The more we have variation in that, the harder it is, or the more bits of precision we need to make it work correctly. You look puzzled. What can I clarify?
I'm not sure what you mean by that point. It's like a distance.
All right, let's take 2 points. Let's start with this one, okay? The D for this point and the S for this point. Let's just make up some numbers. Let's suppose that is, I don't know, we'll say that D is 8. But the S for that point would be, 5. Since it's far, which we get by looking up in here, since it's farther away, then we'll say it's in shadow, right? The S is smaller than the D, it's definitely in shadow. For this point, we're instead going to say the D is 5 and the S is also 5. Does it get shadowed? Well, normally we'd say no, this is then casting the shadow. Okay, but we have rounding error. We have quite a bit of rounding error in the depth buffer. We also have rounding error in our Z transformations, right? These are not exact, so we might be slightly off. And so we're going to have to bias the results. So we're just going to say, everything is a little bit closer than we said it was. We're going to pretend that was 4.9. We're going to pretend that was 7.9 or something like that. But whatever the fuzz factor is we pick, if it's too small, we'll sometimes get artifacts where we'll see things shadowing themselves. If it's too big, we'll sometimes have something too close to something and it won't show shadow. So this only works if things are sort of big and similar distance and so on. Other questions? All right. Shadow volumes. This one's a little harder to describe. It's more commonly used today after people figured out how to make this work. but it's a little tricky to describe. So let's go through the different steps. Okay. This will work for lights of any type. We can have sunlights, we can have point lights. They need to be crisp boundaries. We cannot make fuzzy shadows with this. So only makes hard, crisp shadows. We either need tiny lights or very distant lights. And what we're going to do is we're actually going to compute the shadow volume all the way out to infinity. Okay, we're going to compute the actual geometry of that. How are we going to do this? Okay, the approach to creating a shadow volume is relatively simple, and it'll be easier to describe if we consider a cube. All right, and we're going to assume that I've drawn the cube from the light's point of view. Okay, so the cube made out of these six shapes. Some of the edges are special. Some of the edges are the boundaries between inward-facing and outward-facing polygons. Okay, and those form an outline of the shape. So each edge connects two polygons. If one of them is facing towards the camera, one of them is facing the way, we have the outline of the object. And what we're going to do is we're going to take our cube. Now let's imagine it from a different perspective. Okay, so here was our cube. We're going to take half of the faces, the ones that are facing towards us, leave them where they are. We're going to add some new faces. We're going to turn each of those edges, we're going to extrude it into a giant quad. Okay? And then if we want to, we can cap it at the end by putting these sort of giantly scaled versions of the other faces over there. Or we can just leave it as is. Okay? So we just extrude out. We take those edges, we turn each of those edges into a quad, we take the stuff that's facing us, keep it where it is, the stuff that's facing away, put it close to infinity far away, and we create a volume. Okay? The geometric complexity of this is big O, the same as we started. We have taken, in general, it's only a sort of one dimension lower number of elements that are along the boundary, and so we've added less than a constant factor new faces, and we create this volume. Yes.
So we're considering the boundary from the light's perspective.
From the light's perspective.
And that's what we project.
And that's what we project. We project it away from the light. Yep. So you take the faces that are facing the light, the faces that are facing away, we move the faces that are facing away much farther away, and we add quads around the boundary. Yeah?
So you can extend the kind of line cast off of one of the edges or one of the vertices as far as you want.
Mm-hmm.
How do you figure out how far you want?
Beyond the end of the scene.
Right. So.
Presumably you create the geometry, you have some notion of how big it is. You just make it bigger than that. Okay? There actually are approaches that actually make them at infinity. It turns out we can do that by using zero W coordinates in our points. This is equivalent to divide by zero gives you infinity. But to do that correctly requires a little bit of nuance. So let's just assume we know nothing is more than 5,000 units away. So we extend everything 10,000 units. We're good. Okay? Now once we create this geometry, that doesn't give us shadows. So I'm going to explain, once we have a shadow volume, how we turn them into shadows. Before I do that, any questions about how we create the shadow volumes? Yeah?
For like actual models, do you do this for triangles?
Yes. So in actual models, everything's turned into triangles. And we actually typically do this on a geometry shader on the hard drive. Or on the hardware, rather, not the hard drive. On the graphics card. So there's a step early on where you can say, given this geometry, make it into different geometry. And this computation is one of the things that people designing those shader languages had in mind. Okay. Other questions about creating these volumes before we see how we turn them into shadows? Okay. Now comes the weird magic. And to talk about the weird magic, we need to talk about the stencil buffer. Graphics can have an arbitrary number of buffers. We have the color buffer, red, green, and blue. We have the depth buffer, depth. We've talked about those things. We can also have something called a stencil buffer. And the idea of stencil buffers is instead of storing floating point values, they're going to store integers. And we can change the operations that occur as we create the stencil buffer. Okay? So we want to have a stencil buffer, and the idea we're going to use for the stencil buffer is we're going to figure out what pixels of the scene are inside the shadow volume. So here's how we're going to do this. Okay. Step one, there's actually different orders of this. We're going to render the backside of the shadow volumes. So turn on backface calling, but frontface calling instead. We render the shadow volumes, but we only put them into the depth buffer. Okay? So we render those into the depth buffer. That gives us a depth coordinate for every point in the scene. And so let's take our little example here, right? We want this to cast some sort of conical shadow on this shape here. So we render the back half of that object. And we actually render it all the way down through the scene. We find the depth of the back of this cone. Okay? Then we render the geometry. Okay? We check the depth buffer to see if we find it. So everything that's behind the back of this object gets depth clipped. But everything that's in front of it doesn't. And as we're rendering our geometry, we go into the stencil buffer. So we just say, if you can see something, if the depth buffer doesn't block it, just set the stencil buffer to 1. And so we end up with a lot of 1s around here, and a lot of zeros back here. Okay? And so we render the scene, we find the areas that are closer than the back of the volume. Okay? And then we render the front of the shadow volume, and we toggle, there's different versions of this, we toggle the stencil. Okay? So now we render the front of the shadow volume. And it is going to come along here, and for some areas, it's going to flip the bits. It's going to flip them back. There's different versions of making this work. Let's talk a little bit about one of these. Where do we have? Oh, so many things about shadows. So here is an actual picture of what we get with this. Nice, crisp shadows. Huzzah, that's the goal. Okay. So what are we going to do, right? We find the shadow volumes, okay, to find out where the shadows go. And then we have these different passes, and there's more steps than I had here, so let's just walk through this, right? Render the scene as if it's completely in shadow. Then for each light source, we use the depth information to render it again. What do we do there? We disable the depth and color buffers, we use backface culling, we set the stencil operation to increment, we draw the backs of the shadow volumes. We render the shadow volumes, we flip to the other side, we change the stencil buffer effect, we get the front and the back with different things, with depth included, and then we render the scene, and we end up overriding some parts of the scene, not overriding others, and the tail end of this, there's like 5 or 6 different operations, but the tail end of this is we will end up with a whole bunch of zeros around here for all the areas that are okay, and ones in here. Then, once we have that stencil buffer that has ones only where the shadows are, then we render the scene again with lighting, and we don't render it anywhere the stencil buffer was one. So it's like pass, 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 but in the end, poof, we get all of the scene. Yes?
What is step 3 to say you render the stencil buffer?
Render the front of the shadow volume and toggle the stencil. There's like a dozen different versions of this. I mean, if it's 1, turn it to 0. There, or decrement it, there's different versions of this. There's versions of this where you set the entire stencil buffer to 1 first and then swap some things. There's actually patents on some of these that haven't expired and have been relatively relatively handled, right? So the Wikipedia article gives the depth pass approach, the depth fail approach, the exclusive OR approach. But one of the techniques it talks about is, where is this? They say, hey, if everything's working okay, great, but if not, you can use the depth fail method by licensing it because it's patented. Okay, and so they have some information about the patents, and you can go read the patent if you want. It's worth pointing out what a patent looks like. I don't know if any of you have ever read a patent. Definitely worth doing from time to time. All right, so here's our patent. Great. This is not the patent page I expected to find. Let's see if this, nope, that didn't work. Oh, this is only the header. Okay, I thought this was an actual link to the patent. I apparently was wrong. Oh, the server's down. All right, well anyway, there's a patent here. And you can read its description. Writing patents, it's its own art. You need to describe enough so that everybody knows what you did. But it's written for lawyers, so anyway. They're very odd things. But anyway, people agree this has been patented and people generally respect this. And so if you want to get this one that does all of the cases pretty well, then you have to license it. But there's other ones that work most of the time, like the depth pass and the exclusive OR, that don't have that, and you can use them instead. It's sort of a different order of how we do the front and the back and the scene with depth buffers and stencil buffers. We can run through this if you would like. This is, yes?
So I understand that this could work for multiple light sources, because it's like you just keep making things one and they go
yep.
the other way, unless toggling goes weird, but you can address that. But How would shadow mapping handle multiple light sources?
So actually, first let's come back to how this one works with shadow multiple light sources. If this object is casting there's two light sources and it's casting two shadows, then I have three different ways of lighting. Four different ways of lighting, right? Nothing, one light, the other light, or both lights. So when we do this, we have to go through this pass separately for each of them to figure out which light sources are visible. And so often what we do with this case, and we'll come back to the other one, is we render the scene without any light. We put that in the color buffer. Then we render the first light with its shadow mapping and add its contributions to the color buffer. Then we render it with the second light and add its contributions to the shadow buffer, the color buffer. And so we can do that for as many lights as we want. All of that actually still works with shadow mapping. We have a different process of deciding if a pixel is in the light or not. And we can actually do it a little bit more efficiently, arguably, because for every point source here, if we think about our fragment shader, we have some amount of ambient light that we just always add. We have some amount of light coming from that thing and some amount of light coming from the next light. And for each of those components, we check and conditionally add or not. And typically, rather than using condition, we actually multiply by 1 or 0 because that doesn't involve a branch in our fragment shader. Does this answer your question? Other questions? Yes?
So do you need multiple stencil buffers, one per light? Or?
You need, you can actually reuse them because you do a multi-pass illumination. Right, so you'll need one stencil buffer for each light shadow. But you'll do one pass of one light, and then we'll do another pass for the next light. Yeah?
The person who's going from stencil buffer to geometry the same as it was for the depth buffer. You know, like how you undo the frosting.
No, we don't care about depth.
Okay, but I mean, how do you go from a stencil buffer to like the ones and zeros like on the geometry? Like the
other? We never put it on the geometry, we only put it in pixels. Okay, so, how do I describe this well? All right, and we render the front and the back of the object. For every pixel, we will have whether it's in shadow or not. Do you want me to talk more about that part or the part that comes after?
From what perspective are we doing?
Everything for shadow buffers except extruding the geometries from the camera's perspective.
If this is our point of view that we're seeing.
Yes.
then those ones and zeros aren't on that plane. They're like
they're in the pixels.
Yeah. Oh, I see, but they're in the okay, I think it makes sense.
Let's see if, right? So as we go along, we will be setting our stencil buffer a few times and rendering fronts and backs of things and checking depth or not checking depth. But we're going to end up with some ones here and zeros everywhere else, okay? In our pixels. This will be a version of the contents of the stencil buffer. And once we have that stencil buffer, which we created by incrementing some things and decrementing some afterwards and using depth to decide whether we do that or not. After we've done that, then we'll come and render the whole scene normally, but we'll only light the pixels which are not in shadow. Other questions? Okay. Stencil buffers can do other weird things. Because you can use them to turn off things. And so you can, for example, render some object that intersects with something and then just make not draw it at all. You don't have to make it in shadow. You can make it invisible here. Draw the stuff behind it and so on. So stencil buffers are used for many sort of odd tricks. If you want to make like a movable cut through something, if you want to try to do some sort of, you can use them for various kinds of simulated reflections and so on, where you render into the stencil buffer to pick a part of the scene that you then render something else in. A reflected version of the scene, the stuff that would be behind, etc. And so they're a fairly common little trick to pull in. If, for example, you want to have, I don't know, your magic portal sitting in the air where behind it you have whatever landscape and so on you are drawing normally, but through the portal instead you show somebody's giant face peering out at you or whatever your game calls for, right? And so how do you do this? You render into the stencil buffer the polygons or polygons that define the opening, and then you switch whether it's where the stencil buffer was one or wasn't one that you draw one or the other of the scenes. So there's lots of little tricks you can do with stencil buffers to make things fancier. Yeah?
So is it called a stencil buffer because like, it's kind of like a stencil, like where you color it in?
And yeah. The concept is, right, if I put a stencil down on something and then spray paint it, I only get the spray paint where the stencil wasn't. And that's the same idea here. Right? I first render what is okay to draw, and then I draw whatever it was I wanted to draw there. And these are the ideas that it was first envisioned for. The fact it could be used for shadows was discovered years after stencil buffers were a common feature. All right. Questions about shadows? I shouldn't. Oh, yeah.
So shadow volumes are better because like, you can do crisper shadows and like, they don't have those weird edge cases?
Yep. But they can only do crisp shadows. So if you want soft shadows, they won't work for you.
You can't like blur the crisp shadow?
It's all based on geometry and what the depth buffer says. There's nothing to blur, right? So if you were going to try to blur it, what you have to do is essentially make many different light sources slightly different positions and do them a whole bunch of times, and that will end up being so inefficient, you might as well have ray traced. Yeah?
You couldn't just use like larger values and then kind of like round them out at the edges or something? If you
would
be like
larger values for what?
So instead of having everything be 0 or 1, you try to get to be 0 or 2 and then fuzz the edges to 1.
Oh, do some sort of blur?
Yeah.
I could do that, but I end up doing a blur in the screen space, because that's where all of these buffers are stored, is in screen space, not in world space. So instead of seeing more fuzz where perspective once, it looked like a blurry shadow instead of a soft shadow. There may be someone that's tried that, but I've never seen it in use. Yeah?
How come this doesn't self-shadow?
Yeah, so it turns out that in practice we will often make this volume, we'll actually often do some sort of flattening across the top here. Because I don't really care about the geometry at the top or the bottom. And so often in practice we'll find that boundary and then we'll just fill it with the simplest polygons we can, which will essentially make the shadow cut across the middle. Other questions? All right, shadows. One more thing to say about shadows. Boy, are there a lot of them. This is the Wikipedia article for shadow mapping, the first technique we discussed. And here are references to different, some of these are technical papers, some of these are specs released by graphics card companies and so on, of different versions of how to do shadow mapping. Okay? And we already looked at like several broad categories of the shadow volumes, and there is more reference there. People are continually trying to make this more efficient. Because all of these techniques we have talked about involve rendering the scene multiple times. And that therefore means we're getting a non-trivial constant slowdown, right? Now we can turn off some features and so on, so it won't necessarily cut your frame rate in a quarter or something to render it four times, but it is going to cut it down a lot. And so if we can make this faster, we can make almost everything faster. And so there's always work on this, and most games will implement multiple versions of it and have a menu somewhere where you can select high quality shadows, medium quality shadows, low quality shadows, no shadows, right? Because this is taking up a lot of time. And so if it's running too slow, this is going to be one of the highest yield things to disable. So if you really decide to go into this space, it is likely that this is a sort of thing that computational research will be ongoing in whatever company you end up with. Whether you'll be doing it, I don't know, right? But there's always efforts to innovate in this space. Okay. Any other questions about shadows before we go to other topics? All right, let's go from that to something much simpler. Let's talk about something that was known when we had Mario Brothers and so on. This is called parallax scrolling. Okay? Really straightforward idea. How do I render something where the background moves slower than the foreground? We just make multiple images and scroll them at different speeds. Okay? This is an idea that came directly from cell animation. So in cell animation, it actually became common to have sheets of glass that you would paint different parts of the scene on and put them in a frame at different positions and move the camera across them to give the illusion of depth. And so in a lot of early animated films, the very first ones hadn't figured this out yet, but by the time you get to, you know, Beauty and the Beast and that sort of era of animated things, there will be the scene where they'll have this static picture of the drawn scene, and then suddenly, whoa, it looks like the camera's moving positions using this technique, okay? And so then video games came along after these approaches got common. And so what do? You render several different backgrounds and you scroll them at different speeds. And this approach is hard to overstate how efficient it is. And so it is often the case that if you can predict with relative accuracy the relative point of view, you can spend all the time you want photorealistically ray tracing all of these scenes statically in advance, and then just put them on a few polygons, and as long as the camera stays relatively same position relative to them, you can get it to look really nice, as if you had a lot of detail, when in fact you just have a few static images with transparent parts. Okay, I have seen less of this in the last last 15 years, but every once in a while you'll still see a case where it pops back up, where somebody has realized we can save ourselves unbelievable amounts of real-time time by statically rendering everything and just doing a little bit of composition. So there's that. I don't have a whole lot to say about this, except that it exists. It works pretty well. Yeah?
Do people do this for shadows, like just the shadow layer over a background? Because that's not likely to change.
I guess I'm not sure what you mean.
Like if there's like fixed lighting in the background and the background isn't really moving much.
Oh, yeah. So it's common to pull out all the bells and whistles for the background. Use full ray tracing, have an artist come in with a brush and fix up the parts you want, render it into an image. And then, so you'll have shadows, you'll have reflections, you'll have everything you want there, right? Although reflections are actually less common, because what if they reflected the foreground? Right. But you can do like have somebody come in and paint a sunset for you or whatever it is you want to do without having to worry about how to make them, because you just have to make one. There are a fair number of other tweaks for sprites. Okay? So a sprite is a generic term for one of these. I have a rectangle, I put an image on it, and then I put it in a 3D scene. And there are other things we can do. For example, we can render on the sprite, we can render a normal map. And then we can do some sort of dynamic lighting. Okay? We can have a handful of sprites we jump between as you change perspectives and then add some sort of blur to try to make it look smooth. There's all kinds of effects here. And sometimes these are often used for sort of 2D games, but they're also often used for sort of the background stuff. Small things that there are lots of in the background, I don't need to waste many polygons on them. I can just make one square for each of them, put a texture map on it, and make it work well. An example, where did I put my example? There was a game, when was this out? Let's guess the 1990s somewhere. I'm probably gonna get the year wrong. Yeah, this is the game. I wonder if we can find a picture of it. Yeah, here's a picture of it. Nope, well, that's a weird picture. Anyway, so there was this 3D game where they were doing, this is a decent picture of it. Let's look at this picture. So this game made a whole lot of people very excited because back in the 90s when graphics wasn't great, you were flying around in a 3D world with all magical creatures floating around and detailed characters. And what did they do? Okay, they did polygons for the terrain. You notice they didn't have very many bits for texture maps, so they just repeated the same thing over and over again. Okay, and then how do you make a caterpillar? You make a square here with a picture on it, and a square here with a picture on it, and a square here with a picture on it, and a square here with a picture on it. For however many there are. And then you have your half a dozen different pictures, so you can have like the legs are going doo, 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 or whatever it is you want, you just render those once, and you don't have any polygonal effort. How do you make a little person on a magic carpet? One triangle, one square with a picture of someone in a magic carpet, right? So this approach in the 90s was a really big deal. And it was giving people a fair amount of money and so on. It is still used today, just not in as dramatic places. How do you render a forest? You make 20 pictures of a tree and randomly position them. Great. And nearby you have actual geometry, and sometimes what you do is you have the real geometry, and you'll have like a high resolution version, and then a low resolution version, and then a static picture. Okay? And you'll jump at different depths between the different models. Or maybe you'll have some region in between where you render them both, one of them partially transparent, to try to smooth over that you did it. But these kinds of effects of going back to what we did 20, 30 years ago is still the way we make things fast today. And so a lot of those techniques, although not computationally interesting, are still effective in making things fast. So that's what I had to say about parallax scrolling and sprites generally. Questions about these ideas? All right, let's talk about other things. Here's a weird picture. But I picked this one because it has a very particular effect we want to talk about, which is bloom. Now, I should comment, in algorithms, there's a very useful thing called a bloom filter that is unrelated to this thing, which is called bloom filtering. Okay? Bloom is basically a result of the fact that chemical film cameras were never perfect. And so if you overexpose some area, it would sort of bleed. It bleed out of the really bright area into other areas and make things look fuzzy and bad. And so while camera technology was always trying to get rid of the bloom, remove the bloom, I think we actually talked about this a little bit early on in the semester too when we were talking about light effects. We had, I think, a picture of, an airplane going down in a sunset. Anyway, this effect is now we have learned from your whole life, you've seen pictures of bright things and this is how they've looked. Now in the real world, bright things don't look like this, okay? There's a tiny bit of this because you have dust on your eye. But basically you get none in the real world. But on images and film, you're used to it. And so signals, this is the effect that causes the projector can only get so bright, but it's really representing something brighter than that. It's blooming out. Okay? So this is the idea of bloom. The bloom shader effect. The light bloom or the glow. And so there's all kinds of approaches, of ideas of how this works. There's even special names. There's the thing called the airy disk, which describes how this works on some chemical films and so on. Question?
So would a company that was trying to make like a realistic VR like graphics, would they not use bloom because you wouldn't be seeing it with your eyes?
They still would, because you're not going to make a realistic VR that has a bright enough bulb that you can hurt your eyes by looking at the sun. Right? So you'll never have the dynamic, or I don't foresee a day where we'll have the dynamic range of the real world in your VR equipment. And therefore, you're always going to be approximating super bright with something that's not.
So does that mean that like, people will sort of always be able to tell the difference between it and the real world
as a fact? It's either that or we're willing to have unsafe things. Right? Even if we just take the lights in this room, if 100% of what you were looking at were as bright as the lights, it would not be good for you. Right? So we are unlikely, I don't foresee the day when a commercially available headset, a software bug could damage your eyes. That just seems an unlikely thing for hardware designers to want to sell. And so I expect we will never see that in a VR headset. I could be wrong. I expect to find a lot of dark games. Nothing is very bright, and then we don't have to worry about this. Okay? Other thoughts, comments, questions before we dive into how we do this? All right. How we do this, there's basically just two things we need to do. So, for bloom. Oh no, I put this in the middle of other tabs. Let's go down here. For bloom. What do we need to do? We need to have high dynamic range. That is to say, we need to know how bright something is, even if it's brighter than we can draw. This is not hard to do as long as we aren't storing things in a fixed buffer or fixed input size, right? So we need to be able to store large numbers for very bright scenes. And then we need to blur. This is really all that's going on, okay? All that's really happening, oh, that's a very small picture. All that's really happening in this picture is we're saying, oh, that is way, 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 way brighter than we can draw. We blur the whole scene, that very, very bright, just blur it a tiny bit. We almost don't blur it. We pretty take like 98% of the light from the pixel here and then 10% from a broad region around it. That blurring function, how much the light contributes if it's farther away, is called the airy disk. You can find various elements of it. It's even described here in the Wikipedia article about how you do this. And there's actually, I believe there's a whole Wikipedia article on it, right? This is how it looks, and there's, probably can't see this very well. There's actually secondary rings that are caused by local diffraction. Okay. So he knows there's a bright spot, and then there's a ring around it, and so on. And this is defined by the diffraction around the edge of your lens aperture. Except in reality, it has different colors, because red diffracts more than blue. And so if you really want to, you can try to simulate this, right? But often, we just pretend it was an exponential spike, and away we go. Yes?
How do you do blurring in, like, on a graphics card? Because each fragment doesn't know the fragments around it.
Yeah, so actually it can.
Okay.
Right? So you can treat the rendered image as a texture and then do a second render where you just look up in that texture its neighboring pixels.
Okay.
Yeah?
We only apply the blur at areas between like maximum visual.
We just do it everywhere. But notice it's very bright in the center and very dim over here. We make that center region about a pixel wide. And so then, unless you have something really bright over a few pixels away, you won't see any of it, or barely will affect it all, is the basic idea. Okay? We can actually figure out, based on how large your simulated lens is, how big this area disk would be, and how much blur you'll get, but it turns out that most humans don't know what it's caused by. And so it doesn't matter if we get it physiologically correct, it just matters do we get cool effects. Okay? And so there's all sorts of things written about the area disk, and if you want to read about that, you can, but you can also just say, let's try something out. Okay? So we want to create this bloom kind of effect. You could say, we'll make a first pass that just renders the bright places, blur that and add it to render of the low places. There's lots of shortcuts for doing this. We will often actually do a pass where we render at low resolution, and then we'll upscale that to the whole scene, and that will blur for us. So we render a low resolution, and then a higher resolution, and a higher resolution, and a higher resolution. We combine them all together, and we get something like blur. And this is a very efficient, fast way of getting bloom. Or we can try to simulate the area disk and get it better. And they even comment about how this became widely used in video games after the technique was published by the authors of Tron 2 in 2004, right? And so you can go and see, you can actually measure it, right? Before 2004, you basically never see it. Then suddenly you start seeing it all the time because somebody showed us how to do it. And then at some point people say, I didn't really care, right? So this is the idea of bloom. It's just a blur with high dynamic range. It's a fancy blur. It's the airy disk instead of something else. There's no E in there, is there? There's no D. E, okay, the airy disk, right? Or some crude approximation by rendering it a lower resolution and upscaling. Bloom. Questions about bloom? Okay. Recently, people have realized that bloom is cooler if it doesn't show up everywhere. So early games, every shot had bloom. There was always something bright and something dark next to it, so you could see the bloom and all the time showed off. Nowadays, people have realized it works a whole lot better if it's like this little gleam on the edge of the texture map. If it's rare, it feels more impressive. And so we're starting to see more of it showing up rarely in times today. Let's talk about this picture. This is actually a photograph, but it's a weird photograph. This is a photograph that you probably can't take with your camera. Let's talk about why not. This is a photograph where we have sort of a similar level of visual distinction in color in the dark regions that are not near the lights and the bright regions where we have sunlight shining directly on the wall. And this is an effect that computational photography thinks a lot about. How do we get the detail in the super bright regions so you can still see there is a stained glass and not just a big bloomed white thing? And also see the details down in the dark parts of the pew, right? Where the difference in actual illumination in the real world is gigantic. And part of this is designed to try approximately to simulate the kinds of things that cause humans to be able to see in different regions. Your optic center looks for contrast as much as it does for color. And so this is the idea here is we want to optimize for contrast. So how do we make this photograph? Well, they have the key down here. Oh, they actually have it for a different photograph. Okay, they have a different version of this photograph. Here is a photograph. Okay, how do we make that? By taking the picture 6 times. Okay, so for 2D pictures, what do? We take the pictures at different levels of exposure, and then we weight them based on how much visual interest there was. Okay, so this region has low visual interest, all of the pixels are about the same. This region has low visual interest, all of the pixels are about the same. But in here, we have high visual interest. So that's the picture we want for that region. for the window, maybe here or here, we have higher visual interests. We're going to sort of do some sort of weighting. So for every pixel, we're going to see how different are its neighbors in each of the images. And we're going to sort of take more of the one where they're more different and less of the others. And the number of neighboring pixels we look at and exactly that the measure we pick will allow us to decide how quickly we go from very low exposure on the window to very high exposure in the dark corner. We don't want it to happen all at once, or you'll see a boundary, you'll see a transition in the human eye. So instead of doing it all at once, we'll do it somewhat gradually so that we'll see this nice smooth thing by comparing the neighboring region. Yes?
So I feel like it would make it look like there's like inconsistent lighting.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so I mean, like, we've looked at two examples of this that are taken from the real world. It looks weird, right? So why would I do this? Because it also shows me what's there, right? Let's think about, I don't know, some sort of fast-paced, adrenaline-based game. If you were in some sort of fast-paced, adrenaline-based game and you looked at the window and the whole scene around you went black, that may increase your adrenaline, but would not necessarily make you a happy gamer, right? So the combined, where I can see what's going on in the bright areas and the dim areas, I can see everything. And our eyes are pretty good at this, right? Our eyes don't suffer much from bloom. Our brain is fairly good at taking very bright, very dark, seeing what's going on everywhere. So if you sit and look at it for a while, you're like, huh, where is the light coming from in this scene? It appears there's this tiny little spotlight that's brighter than the sun. How did that happen? But you don't see that when you glance at it. You see, oh, this is an interesting interior of a chapel. Right? And so this is the idea of what we want to do with what we call tone mapping. This is an area where I have not been able to figure out if there is a best practice today. You're starting to see some games describing that they do tone mapping. I have not seen a lot of papers that are saying somebody else did it, but we did it a tiny bit better, which is usually a sign the discipline is converging. Instead, you see a small number of papers that describe it in very different ways. It's all some version of, we collect high dynamic range images, and if it's bright everywhere around here, we tone it down. If it's dark everywhere around here, we tone it up. But the definition of around here, the computation for doing that does not, as far as I can tell, does not appear to be something the graphics community has converged on yet. And so this is an area that I expect we'll see at some point in the next few years, we will start seeing, right? So you notice even all of their examples on the Wikipedia article, this is actually worth noting, okay? So they have a little bit about how it works, then they say digital photography, display devices, examples, and visual effects. None of those are games, right? They're all these other things. I'm fairly sure the day will come where some successful game will do this well. Somebody will either figure it out and publish it on some forum somewhere, or those people will publish a paper and we'll start seeing it everywhere. And I expect it won't be that far because the space in the computational photography and so on seems to be maturing nicely. And maybe it's already happened and I just couldn't find the papers. But I think this is likely to be one we will see a lot more of in the near future. So, questions about tone mapping. I realize I haven't given you an algorithm because I don't know the one that people use. I mean, I know the hand-wavy explanations, but not the whole thing. Okay. 10 minutes parallax mapping. This is not going to go well. All right. Before we jump to parallax mapping, any questions about the things we've already talked about? Okay. Then let's do the motivating example for parallax mapping. We have a little animation. How many triangles does this animation require? Let's try that again. I've heard a lot and two. The answer is two. How? What is it doing? You'll notice that we only have anything inside the square. Nothing appears outside the square. And yet we have lighting, we have shadows, we have occlusion, we have this complicated seeming geometry inside the square. How do we get this to work? Okay. The answer is something called parallax mapping. There's several versions of this, but let's just start with the core idea because I don't have time to go into all the versions. Okay. Let's start with, we're going to have a height map. Meaning at every texel, we're going to have how high it's supposed to be. I should probably actually call this a depth map, except we use depth for something else. And the reason I should say it's a depth map is because parallax mapping, for whatever reason, always makes the geometry below the plane. Okay? So it can go from the plane to deeper down. But we call it a height map, not a depth map, because depth map means something else. It just happens to be always negative heights. We want to know the basic process we want to know. Let's change this to 1D instead of 2D, right? We have whatever our texture is here. We have the eye looking at it at some angle. And what we want to know is what texel should we look up? Okay? So we know we hit at this point. Because the geometry is underneath, it's either there or farther away. And in practice, the imaginary ray maybe hits there, and so maybe this is the texel we want to look up. So we want to know this sort of offset texel. How far away is the texel we want to look up? Now we can bound this. Because the heights have some bounded range from 0 to 1, okay, and we have some depth here, and because we know the angle of incidence, we can say, well, if you hit nothing, as far away as you could go is here. And so it's going to be somewhere in this range. Okay? Or if this was 2D, that would be somewhere in a line across the texel, which we could find with DDA or something like that. Okay? So the simple way of doing this, and this is actually what's done sometimes, is I figure out what that range is, and then I just literally run a loop. I just check every single one of those texels. Okay? And then for each one, I say, okay, what's the height there? Is that going to, and how far away is it? That gives me some other angle. Is it something I saw? And as soon as I bump into one I saw, I am done. So I start a loop down it until I find it, and then I say, ah, I got it. There are approaches that use some sort of binary search or so on, but the linear search is the most common. I don't know if it's actually the most common. It's the one I see written about the most. It's always hard to know what people are really using unless they open source their stuff. Okay? So we are going to check a bunch of texels. We're going to compute based on its height map and the angle of incidence whether this is the one we see. And if it's not, we keep going until we find one. Often what we will actually find is that the one we ought to hit is between two other texels. So go for one that was below the line of sight to one that was above the line of sight, and then we can linearly interpolate between them to find out where we want to be. This is the core idea of parallax mapping. We're going to have a height map. We're going to do this sort of really, really simplified version of ray tracing. Right? We are effectively ray tracing a height map, but we're taking advantage of all kinds of special things we know about it to do that, to only check a very small number of the virtual polygons that make up this height map. The other thing we need to have on top of that is a normal map. Okay? So for each of these texels, we're going to have its height, but we're also going to have the xy coordinates of its normal. How is it tilted? And that way, once we find the texel, we not only know its color, but we also know what angle it's facing. And we can use that in our lighting to make it illuminated. And thus, we can have it look like the lighting is moving around as it twists. We can even do specular highlighting and so on in our shape. Okay? Which gives us this nice behavior everywhere except at the edges. There's bunches of ways of doing this. This article is very brief. Okay? But it has some reasonable external links. It has this article, Practical Dynamic Parallax Occlusion Mapping, which you have to get from the Wayback Machine because this page went away. But it's actually quite a good presentation. It links to some other papers. If you want to do this, I found this one was well described. They also have two side discussions, which are actually longer articles in Wikipedia as well. I found this, although it's very brief, to actually be a reasonable introduction. One of the things you will find in places that use this, let's take an example in our last few minutes. I want to draw a brick wall. So I make my parallax occlusion mapping, height maps and normal maps where the bricks should be. And that will all work nicely. It'll look like my bricks have depth and you can see between them and so on, but the edges will still be crisp. What do we do about the crisp edges? We add some sort of actual 3D geometry of some sort of boundary of the wall that pokes out beyond it so that you can't see the edge. Okay, you do some sort of, this is actually something that some architecture types really did. Or if you want to have a cobbled street, you make sure the edges of the cobbled street have something going over top of them. You cover the edges. And then nobody can see the edges, and they can't tell that you didn't have an extremely highly detailed model when really you just had a triangle and a fairly expensive kind of texture mapping. Yeah?
You do have to make sure the map on the most of the wall lines up with the objects on the boundary, right? Or because otherwise that'll still look
right. Right. You need to make sure that this works out correctly at the boundary. Since there's various little tricks, often what you do is you make this geometry. Let's see if I can draw. Okay, so here is my parallax occlusion mapping, and the geometry I put over here literally covers it with some overlap. And so as you're looking at it, you can see underneath it for a little ways, but that's okay. Sometimes instead, there are other things you can do. You actually have the parallax occlusion mapping go to zero depth at the boundaries. So it just gets shallower until it looks flat, and then the fact it's actually flat works okay. That's usually looks a little weird. But this is one of the things that almost all of the papers I looked at said. They said, we do this, and then we do something special at the boundaries, right? And so we can get this effect. It's been around for 15 years, but it's still something that you see arguably less commonly than I would have expected. It's a fair amount of work, right? We have an actual, like, check many texels based on an angle. This is not a trivial fragment shader. And so it takes significantly slower to render this than to render a different polygon. And so getting a scene where that's a good trade-off is not necessarily an easy thing to do. All right. We still have 3 minutes, but that's what I had prepared to say today. Anything else you'd like to talk about real-time eye candy? I should mention something we haven't mentioned yet that's nonetheless useful to know. Particles. This is an older technique, but the idea is really simple. Particles are sprites that you bounce around the scene as if they're little points. Okay? So how do you make an explosion? You make a picture of a cloud of smoke. You make like 8 of them. You make them move apart a little bit. A growing poof of smoke that seems to get fainter as it goes. Right? If you want to have some sparks in there, you make some little ones that glow, that they fly a little bit faster. Right? Particle effects are used extensively in 3D real-time games, and sometimes even in 2D. How do you make a fountain? You make a thing that looks like a fuzzy droplet of water. Fuzzy actually is kind of important, so you don't expect anything to bounce. You shoot a whole bunch of them up out of the top of it and let them bounce around and then fade away. Okay? Particle effects are a cheap way of simulating gas, water, explosions, fire, whatever you want. You get the right billboard. You make enough of them moving, people can't see their boundaries, and you're good to go. I still have 30 seconds. Anything else you want to talk about today? All right. On Thursday, we'll come talk about the other end, the high-end movies. I will see you all on Thursday.